holding on. You're holding me back. I wonder why.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Off the Hour, right here on CQT 90.3 FM. We are 3 days into the month of March. We are broadcasting from unceded Mohawk and Anishinaabe territory. You are tuned into The Avalanche, a special presentation of CQT's Community News Department. The Avalanche seeks to cover issues affecting those with disabilities. I'm your host, Zoe. On today's show, an episode of AAWW Radio featuring an interview with Leah Lakshmi. All that on CQT 90.3 FM. You're listening to The Avalanche, where all abilities are welcome. If you'd like to get involved, you can call 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or email news at cqut.ca. You can also follow us on Twitter at @avalancecqt.
The alert level in your region or a neighboring region is red. To curb the spread of COVID-19, gatherings with family and friends are prohibited, and travel between regions should be avoided. In red zones, it's also forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. Visit quebec.ca/coronavirus to learn more about the specific measures addressing the situation. Follow all the rules, all the time, no exceptions. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CQUT 90.3 FM. CQUT's funding drive is coming up. If you're interested in supporting news produced by and for the Montreal community, consider supporting us between March 18th to 28th. You can make donations online at cqut.ca or by phone at 514-448-4041. Stay tuned for more updates. On today's show, we have an episode of the Asian American Writers Workshop Radio, featuring an interview with Dreaming Disability Justice author Leah Lakshmi. That's up now.
You want to do it? You want to start? You want me to start?
We're so generous, Leah.
We're on it. This is the Saray and Leah show.
Okay.
Yeah, this is what, this could be like a 9 million podcast idea that never happens, but that everyone, you know what I mean? Like,
I'm sure I've actually pitched this podcast to you.
Hello, this is Sophia Hussein, Programs Coordinator at the Asian American Writers Workshop. Welcome to our podcast, AAWW Radio. Every week, we bring you hand-picked audio from the literary events we host in New York City. AAWW is a national nonprofit dedicated to the belief that Asian American stories deserve to be told. We organize author talks and grant fellowships to emerging writers of color. We publish the online magazines, The Margins and Open City, and we fund workshops for high school students and senior centers. In her essay collection, Care Work, Dreaming Disability Justice, Leah Lakshmi Piepsna Samarasingha asks the question, what the hell is disability justice? How do collective care, disability justice, and sick and disabled Black and brown femmes save the world and each other during this time of apocalypse? Or do we? What are the histories and present-day struggles and triumphs of disabled Black and brown queers in our movements and communities? The essay collection outlines what it means to create spaces by and for sick and disabled queer people of color and creative collective access. Access not as a chore, but as a collective responsibility and pleasure in our communities and political movements. Care Work is a mapping of access as radical love, a celebration of the work that sick and disabled queer and people of color are doing to find each other and build power and community, a toolkit for everyone who wants to build radically resilient, sustainable communities of liberation where no one is left behind. In this episode of AAWW Radio, Leah reads from Care Work, then sits on the green couch with her friend Saray Jarrell Johnson. Saray is a writer and author of Slingshot, his forthcoming book of poetry, and a founding member of the Harriet Tubman Collective and Deaf Poets Society. Together, they talk about disability justice, the nuances and multitudes of the disability experiences, Crip wealth, and the decolonial disabled future. Here's Saray Jarrell Johnson, who introduces Leah.
So I am here to introduce my friend and one of my big life inspirations, Leah Lakshmi Piepsna Samarasingha, who is a queer disabled femme writer, organizer, performance artist, educator of Berger, Tamil, Sri Lankan, and Irish Roma ascent, as you all well know. The author of Care Work, Dreaming Disability Justice, which we are here to celebrate today. Dirty River, a queer femme of color dreaming her way home, which was awarded the ALA Above the Rainbow list, shortlisted for the Lambda and a Publishing Triangle Awards. Body Map, which was shortlisted for the Publishing Triangle Award, Love Cake, Lambda Literary Award winner, and Consensual Genocide. With Chingy Chen and Jay Dulani, she co-edited The Revolution Starts at Home, Confronting Intimate Violence in Activist Communities. Leah's next two books, Tongue Breaker and Exploring Transformative Justice, A Reader, co-edited with Ajaris Dixon, are forthcoming in 2019, so look out for that. A lead artist with Disability Justice Performance Collected Sins Invalid since 2009, Leah's writing has been widely anthologized and published, with recent work featured in PBS NewsHour, Poets.org, Poetry in the Body Folio, The Deaf Poet Society, Bitch, Self, Truth Out, and The Body is Not an Apology. Her essays have appeared in Glitter and Grit. Oh, wait for it, though, y'all. Octavia's Brood, Dear Sister, Undoing Border Imperialism, Stay Solid, Persistent, Still Butch and Femme, Yes Means Yes, Visible, A Femthology, Homelands, Colonize This, quintessential masterpiece. I know y'all are still reading it. We Don't Need Another Wave, Bitch Fest, Without a Net, Dangerous Families, Brazen Femme, and A Girl's Guide to Taking Over the World. From 2006 to 2015, Leah co-founded and co-directed Mangoes with Chili, a groundbreaking queer and trans people of color performance tour and in collective. She co-founded Toronto's Asian Arts Freedom School in 2006. She is a Vona Fellow and holds an MFA from Mills College. She is also a Rust Belt poet, a Sri Lankan with a white mom, a femme over 40, a grassroots intellectual, a survivor who is hard to kill, and of course, let's never forget, the author of the Femme Shark Manifesto. Let's welcome to the stage Leah Lakshmi Piepsna Samarasingha.
Please give it up for the one and only indubitable Saray Jarrell Johnson. Also, Hi, this is so lovely. Thank you all for being here. I don't even know what day it is. I wrote an essay in a Facebook note today where I was like, you know, like, I think that one, people were like, well, you're not really disabled because you go on these tours. And I was just like, you know, you don't, I just spent all day in my underwear, you know, just kind of like staring into space. And honestly, if this is going to be like, not that this isn't authentic, but I'm just like, I really kind of want to be up here in like the sweatpants with the toothpaste smear, you know, which is kind of a, and like the hair and stuff like that. And I might like actually go ahead and do that next time I do stuff. I'm so, so, so happy for everybody who made it here through inaccessible transit and no spoons and exhaustion and pain and all of the terrible, horrible of this world. And I also want to, the live stream's going. Live stream's going. Okay, cool. So if people are joining us on live stream, thank you all for being here too. I was thinking a lot about what I wanted to bring to this space today, and that long ass bio, there was not, you know, I left out some stuff, which is that I came here as a full scholarship kid to NYU in 1993, you know, really different time. And I was really crazy and hallucinated my whole first year on the N train. And I was really sick. And, you know, there's at least one person here who remembers those days. Hi. I love you too. I'm so glad you're here. And I just was thinking about, you know, the words of the great disabled queer poet Laura Hershey in one of her last poems, Translating the Crip, where she says, you know, here we are, thriving and unwelcome in this the only space and time. And I just think about, like, all of us and everyone who's watching us from bed and everyone who's not here who's thriving and unwelcome. And about the specific ways, I mean, every place you go, people are like, okay, the access is really bad. I'm like, the access is really bad everywhere. And New York, as I don't have to tell you, is a special form of hell on earth. So I just think about, and there's a way in which disability is both hyper-visible and invisibilized at the same time, you know, like we're always pointed at, and then people are like, you don't really exist. And I think there's a way that this city, you know, that kind of blends with all of us, where it's just like we're all here and we're all hyper feeling the lack of access and all of like the holes and the limits in terms of disability community and social justice community that gets disability justice. And we're also here making our way. So does that make sense? Okay. They were like 20 minutes. And I was like, you know, I'm autistic and I like go up here and I talk a lot. And sometimes it's like an hour and a half and people were just crying and shit. But I'm going to try and keep it to 20 minutes and just be focused. I don't know how it's going to go. yeah. So what I want to say, too, is that, you know, I wasn't kidding about the sweatpants. And I feel like when you hear that whole long list, I feel complicated about it because I'm really proud of the stuff I've done and the work I've put in. And I also really want to say that there were and will be many years where I was a fuck up who was not being a productive, socially capital person at all. And all of our abilities to make and do anything as sick and disabled and neurodivergent and deaf and mad, black and brown folks and white folks and queer folks and trans folks, it's not possible unless there's actually the container of radical disability justice culture. I didn't write about my disability for 31 years. You know, like Body Map came out 3 years ago. That was my third book of poetry. That was the first one where I mentioned, oh yeah, you know, I have this weird thing. You know, I don't really talk about it. And that would not have been possible without the labor of Patty Byrne, Leroy Moore, Mia Mingus, Eli Clare, Sebastian Margaret, and also Billy Raines, Therese Jarrell, Tina, like all of these people, all of y'all, so many people in this room who, you know, Tourmaline, like so many people who've been breaking silence about sickness and disability from an intersectional perspective that looks at our ancestors, looks at environmental racism, looks at colonization, and also looks at the future, right? And that's something I try and hold on to. I don't know. People are like, you're weirdly optimistic for a sarcastic, depressed person. And I'm like, yeah, I know. I don't know what the thing is. I mean, it's like, I just feel like my childhood was so fucked up. Everything's uphill from there. So I'm like, great. I'm not at my parents' house. This is awesome. But I will say one of the things about bringing this book into the world, well, two things. I'll say this and then another and then I'll read stuff, is that, you know, I mean, we're on year two of Trump, and it's not like we have not been surviving the end of the world for forever. But, you know, it's been a special kind of like apocalypse, 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 apocalypse. And I know that for me, I mean, I would say that again, but we just all get more depressed than we already are. I I've had a really hard time reaching for the future that I want in the last 2 years, because I feel like so many of us, we're just fighting to maintain the bare minimum that's completely inadequate that we already have, right? I mean, you look at like all of like the ADAPT and not dead yet protesters fighting to keep Medicaid and the ACA and the ADA, and like those are already inadequate. Like there's already, I can't get Medicaid. Like my friends can't get Medicaid. Some of them can, some of them can't. You know, we, like some of y'all in here may be familiar with the disability justice, like being like, we love the ADA, we're grateful. Also, what if you can't sue? You know, what if you're not a citizen? What if you believe that this is just a settler colonial hallucination that we're in? You know, I mean, it's both and. But having said that, it feels like this is the only time, Unwelcome and Thriving, to release the book that's trying to really hard to dream a future where we win and there's a decolonial disabled future, right? Where we're not just tolerated, we're at the center. I'm wearing this like already fading ass Teespring shirt that says the future is accessible. You know, you can stare at my tits, it's fine, it's consensual. It was really cool at the Disability and Intersectionality Summit in Boston because there was like 12 people all the same shirt and we were like, yeah. And I was like, wow, yeah, imagine a future without stairs. Imagine a future without toxic waste. Imagine a future with reparations. Imagine a future with no medical fucking torture. Imagine a future where you get your wheelchair as soon as you need it. Imagine a future where your rheumatologist doesn't make fun of you. Right? You know, imagine a future with like mainstream, like everybody ASL, like in thriving deaf communities. Like imagine a future where autistic people are valued, whether we are, where the words high and low functioning don't exist. Right? Like, I want to imagine that future. And should I read some pieces from this thing? Yeah. Okay, cool. I'm probably at 10 minutes already. Okay. So I also, the other thing was that people were like, yeah, this is, the time's really ripe for a disability justice book, and we'll publish it, you know, if you can be like the leader of the movement. And I was like, fuck you, no. And I was like, that's not gonna fucking work. And I'm just like, this is a bunch of weirdos that nobody else gives a shit about, but we give a shit about each other. And so I also was very, very conscious of myself as an ambulatory light-skinned person. And I was just like, no. However, it was a trip looking for the blurbs where I was like, oh, all the disabled black and brown folks self-publish. Yeah, because you know when you look for blurbs, they want you to get somebody who's more published than you. And it was like white disabled people, often in academia. And I was like, oh my God, this is where we are. And I'm very, I forgot to put the cards up, but I'm very happy that this book is out there with Aurora Levins Morales' book, with Leroy Moore's new book, and like new books, plural, with Alice Wong's Resistance and Hope, which is an incredible anthology with people in the room of like disabled, mostly POC, writing about resistance that you can get for free on Smashwords, $5 on Amazon. And I just want us all to keep writing and producing, you know, in all of our wild disability dreams and visions as black and brown people and as intersectional people, because I don't want to be a fucking star. I want to be part of the fucking universe that I'm already a part of. Okay. So I'm going to start out by reading a quote from my really good friend, Stacey Milburn, disabled, Korean, queer, femme. Actually, I'm not sure if they identify as femme anymore, but like badass, wonderful activist and writer, who I'm kind of like lovingly like being like, you need to write a book, boo, because all these Facebook posts, you know, everyone's like, Stacey. Okay, so just breathe this one in. I have loved disabled people of color my whole adult life, and I am still amazed to discover that the more I love our people, the more I remember where I come from. I remember that my ancestors found each other out, seeing each other in the unseen. My ancestors knew that asking after one another and making sure that people had what they need, what we might today understand as collective access, was the only way to be together. Together, the best shot at staying alive. My ancestors knew the power of vulnerability and how to hold each other in dignity. My ancestors knew joy. My ancestors made mistakes and meditated on who they wanted to be in community. My ancestors became those people. You can clap, you cannot clap, it's all good. Yeah, you know? Yeah. So this is a brief excerpt from the preface, which is called Writing with a Movement from Bed. When I moved to Oakland in 2007, I started writing from bed. I mean, I'd already been doing it, but I started having a name for it. I wrote in old sleep pants, lying on a heating pad during the hours I spent in my big, sick and disabled femme of color bed cave, and I wasn't alone. I did so alongside many, many other sick and disabled writers making culture, because writing from bed is a time-honored disabled way of being a cultural worker, one the mainstream doesn't mostly acknowledge, but whose lineage stretches from Frida Kahlo painting her corset in bed to Grace Lee Boggs writing revolutionary Asian-American Detroit miracles in her wheelchair at age 98. I had very good timing. I moved to Oakland just as disability justice was birthing ourselves as a movement. Disability justice is a term coined by the Black, brown, queer, and trans, and working class white members of the original Disability Justice Collective, founded in 2005 by Patty Byrne, Mia Mingus, Leroy Moore, Eli Clarence, Bastian Margaret. They dreamed up a movement-building framework that would center the lives, needs, and strategies of disabled queer and trans and or Black and brown folks, marginalized both from mainstream disability rights organizing's white-dominated single-issue focus and the ableism of most of our Black and brown social justice movements. Sins Invalid, the performance collective co-created by Patty and Leroy, was shaking things up with its large-scale, beautifully produced performances about our sex, bodies, struggles, its use of a culture as a weapon to reshape people's dreams, nightmares, and future visions of what our liberation could look like. The writings of writers like Mia Mingus, Stacey Milburn, Aurora Levens Morales, and Billy Rain were being passed around from hand to hand in communities I was a part of. I was reading them over and over again, silently in my room, my brain breaking open. I'd never seen disabled, queer, and trans, Black, Indigenous, and people of color writing about the nitty-gritty of our lives before without apology. We were finding ourselves and finding each other and making space that held our desires and stories online, in conversations in corners, outside of the elevator in BART. It even felt like some non-disabled people were paying attention, being forced to deal with ableism and with us, whether or not they were thrilled about it. And as we were giving birth to ourselves, I got to be part of it as a cultural worker working for bed. As I was able to perform with Sins Invalid, that experience refused to stay in one little corner of my life. I wanted every single Cutie BIPOC cultural space I took part in to be that accessible, that whole. I wrote pieces about cross-disability access that were tools that we used to help create the first Creating Collective Access Network, an experiment in access made by and for sick and disabled Cutie BIPOC people at the 2010 Allied Media Conference that broke away from the traditional format of access as service begrudgingly offered, if at all, to disabled people by non-disabled people who feel grumpy about it, to access as a collective joy and offering that as disabled Black and brown folks we can give to each other. Finding other creators and building with them made me write about what it was like to create performing art spaces where access was a central part of the performance, not an afterthought. As queers and femmes in my communities, particularly queer femmes of color and multiply marginalized femmes, continued to kill themselves, I wrote about suicidality as an ever-present reality in our communities and in my life. And this is a big deal, because when I got sick in 1997, nobody in my anti-racist, anti-police brutality, Black and brown community talked about illness. When I got sick and I couldn't mail out 200 letters, I got a snort and like, oh, you're really sick, and people didn't call me back. Before I ran into Sins, like many other people I knew, I thought of disability as something that you weren't allowed to talk or write about in our cultures. Nowhere in the Cutie BIPOC politicized spoken word communities I was a part of or wanted to be cool enough to be part of in the early 2000s do I remember anyone doing poetry about disability. I mean, come on. Do you remember any poems about disability justice in Deaf Poetry Jam? You may not remember Deaf Poetry Jam. I'm old. It's okay. I know you remember Deaf Poetry Jam. And none of this happened because able-bodied people decided to be nice to the cripples. It happened because we turned towards each other. And we turned towards each other in ways that looked very different than the traditional activism that we had been pushed out of. It looked like Tumblr and blog and social media posts, or like three people getting together at a kitchen table or a group Skype call to start to hesitantly talk through thoughts about activism and survival, about our lives, organize a meal train, share pills, or post the thoughts about survival we have at 2 a.m. Our work is underdocumented private work, work often seen as not real activism, but it is the realest activism there is. This is how disability justice, art, and activism change the world and save lives. These pieces are a small part of them. How am I doing for time? Thank you. Thank you. And I'm a terrible person because the first piece is like a 50-page essay, but it's in like 17 segments. And I'm just going to read a little bit at the beginning. And it's called Care Web's Experiments in Creating Collective Access. Do you have the car today? Hayati, I'm at the bus stop. I hurt so bad. Can you pick me up? Can I borrow $20? Can you go buy groceries for me when you're out and drop them off? Here's a list. You want to go to community acupuncture together? I've got the car today. Hey, B needs more care shifters. Can you repost the Facebook note? Can we share the Access van ride over to the city? If you come, you can say you're my PCA and you won't have to pay. Do you have any anemone tincture you could bring over? I'm flaring. Holding me would be good too. If I take your manual wheelchair and load it up with takeout, we'll all have food even though you can't walk all the way over there. Can you go with me to the clinic and take notes while I talk to that asshole doctor? Can I use the address for the easy desert pickup? I'm just over the border into Oakland from Berkeley. Let's pass the hat so we can afford ASL. Do you have the interpreter list? Here's the list of accessible event spaces we made up on Google Docs. Can you be part of my mad map? Want to Skype if you can't get out, even if we live two blocks away from each other? Want to go with me to the food stamp office? Can you pick up an ace for me when you go to the dispensary? Collective access and care ribs have been happening for a really long time. But I ask, what does it mean to shift our ideas of access or and care, whether it's disability, childcare, economic access, or more, from an individual chore, an unfortunate cost of having an unfortunate body, to a collective responsibility that's maybe even deeply joyful? How does it change our lived experiences of disability and chronic illness? What does it mean to wrestle with these ideas of softness and strength, vulnerability, pride, asking for help and not, all of which are so deeply raced and classed and gendered? If collective access is revolutionary love without charity, how do we learn how to love each other? How do we keep loving each other after we learn that we don't know how to love each other yet? How do we learn to do this love work of collective care that lifts us up instead of abandons us, that grapples with all the deep ways in which care is so much more complicated than just call me if you need something? And I'm just going to read two more segments. Recently on a conference call, a completely well-meaning able-bodied person who was trying to hire me asked, okay, we're really excited to have you. We just have one question. Okay, what is disability justice? Like, how will we know when we're doing it? Thank you for laughing. I really needed this job. I was so glad we weren't on Zoom, just on a phone call so they couldn't see my face. I said something diplomatic and positive, and in my head, I was like, oh, you wanna know how you're gonna know if you're doing disability justice? You're gonna know you're doing it because people will show up 4 hours late, someone will vomit, someone else will have a panic attack, someone will vomit and have a panic attack. Nothing will happen on time, ever. The ramp on the supposedly accessible building will be broken and no one will be surprised. You're not gonna meet your benchmarks on time or ever. Also, we won't be grateful to be included. We will want to set the agenda. And what our leadership will look like might look like changing an ostomy bag in the middle of a meeting. Being really nuts, not just once in a while, but every day. It's slow. It's people that even the most well-meaning social justice-abled person stares at or gets freaked out by or just thinks is a little depressing. Disability justice looks like what many mainstream people have been taught to think of as failure. Disability justice, when it's really happening, is too wild and messy to fit into traditional movement, nonprofit, industrial structures, because our bodies and minds have always been too wild to fit into those structures, and that's on purpose because the nonprofit industrial complex was invented to manage dissent, and it was based on what people don't talk about, including a lot of able feminists of color, the model of charities, which were invented to lock us up and make a lot of money on us during colonialism as disabled people. That's why nonprofits never give disabled Black and brown folks money to run anything, because they need us as clients and we're not competent. And it's so easy at this moment in history for very well-meaning people to look at a list of disability justice principles and go, yeah, yeah, that sounds good, and put we're against ableism on their list. But the real deal is messy and beautiful as our body minds. And it is always something that I can't really get across in a soundbite, but I will try for you. It's more like disability justice is you and your friend are really, really stressed out about Trump. So you decide to plan a performance art show about how our disabled Black and brown ancestors survived fascism, because they did. Your friend has a traumatic brain injury and dealing with forms and email does not work for them, but you're autistic in a certain way. So you write a successful grant to the City Arts Commission in 3 hours with your hyper-focus. You, however, get completely overwhelmed and aphasic if more than one person talks to you at once. So you're sitting in a corner freaking out right before the show while they blissfully, with their Leo chillness, it's like, oh, you need $45 worth of props? No problem. Oh, you, it's 30 minutes long? Not 10? Great. And the show goes on. The gay theater staff is well-meaning, but they're completely overwhelmed. So they do absolutely nothing, they promise, and you have to produce, direct, fundraise, and perform. Every single artist is interested, but it's like herding cats to get them to write you back. But when you talk to them, they're like, no one's ever asked me to be in a sick and disabled cutie BIPOC show before. Am I really an artist? Do I really get to say all that crazy shit on stage? Your co-coordinator has a really hard time getting the ASL interpreters to write back, and then when they do, books them for all four nights. When you get the bill, it's three times as high as you budgeted for because the agency refused to give you a quote. The live stream dives halfway through because your computer's old, and someone gets really mad and tweets about how you're letting the community down. You are emceeing 2 minutes after blowing an ovarian cyst. However, you have a community where you can be real about that and not pretend, and they actually send you love and Reiki and stuff like that. And the show goes on. And at the end, despite or because it all, you and your friends still love each other. Everyone says that the show helped them get through January. And when you are $1,200 short on the ASL, a former disability justice collective that went bust due to so much internal drama, gives you the rest of the money in their account that they don't know what to do with, and a community member who's an elder wins a huge settlement against SSDI by showing up at the office every day for 3 months and says, kid, meet me at the ATM, and gives you $250 in 20s and 10s because you kept them housed when they were in the nursing home and they couldn't pay the rent by passing the hat at last year's show. Disability is a set of innovative, virtuosic skills. Thanks. Okay. Okay, I'm gonna... I might end on more of a thing than a woo thing, you know, but I think, you know, we can handle it. And, you know, I don't know. Everyone's always like, your thing is that, like, you just make people cry for 2 hours and you swear. And I was like, yeah, that's pretty much it. That's pretty much it. Yeah, it's my specialty. And, like, they're like, you wear those sparkles. And I'm like, it's all the same $7.99 skirt from H&M. I got, like, six of them, you know. It's like the uniform. It's great. So me and Stacey wrote this piece called, do I want to read this piece? Okay. I will say that, like, you know, like, I'm a survivor and survivorhood is normal and there's a lot of survivors in the room and, like, we're in the middle of, like, a mass apocalyptic breaking open of survivor stories that is not new, and it is new and it's this moment in time, and I just want to honor that. So, I wrote this piece that, man, I had to really fucking fight because I had a really fucked up copy editor who was just like, I don't understand what you're talking about anything. And I was like, yeah, did you think people understand what ableism is? And I was just like, it's like the death rattle. But I wanted to write this. I was just like, I want to write this piece about how traditional ways of thinking about survivorhood are rooted in ableism. And it's like a master's thesis, or not a master's thesis because fuck the master. But I was just like, yeah, it's like the grand unified theory of everything. Yeah, this is also a disability justice thing where someone's like, you're so successful in gamist. And I'm like, I just look like another nutcase in sweatpants who just can't get their life together, who's having a lot of ideas, and that's who I am. And somehow it's worked out, you know, enough. So thank you. Long story short, I just, like, basically the gist of it, I was like, you know, as a survivor, I think we have a lot of trauma and we want less pain. And then the models that are out there are cured and fixed or broken, right? So then we still have stuff that comes up. I've seen so many survivors being like, I'm not surviving right, and I feel so much despair because I'm still triggered, I'm still sad, I'm still learning new stuff about my survivorhood. And the only model up there is like, and it's even in, I talk a lot of shit about the courage to heal, but I just do, where they're just like, you know, eventually, you know, the trauma passes away and you get married and it's just chill and you live in Santa Cruz and you're white and it's fine. And like, you only got raped the one time and that was it. And you know, it's cool and nothing bad happens. And I'm like, that's not really my experience. It's like a fucking decathlon of bullshit, you know? So basically I just was like, yeah, cure is bullshit. What does it mean to actually take disability justice thinking and anti-ableist thinking and be like, what if I'm still about fucked up but living a really great life? So this is a section called old bitch survivors who cry and laugh. As a young young survivor, I read a lot of survivor writing, the feminists of color, slam poetry, Sapphire, Dorothy Allison kind, and what I picked up on was telling the raw truth could heal you even if it was too much for most people. Running away could heal you. Cutting off somebody's dick or hand could heal you. Lorena Bobbitt was really in the news as I graduated from high school. Sex could heal you, and not having sex could heal you, and solitude and a closed door. But what I didn't see much of was stories of what came after, what long-term survivorhood looked like after you've been trying to have the courage to heal for a while. And I wanted an option besides normality or suicide. And it would have meant a lot to me if I'd seen stories and pictures of middle-aged or older survivors who were happy and yet not done, who were a lot less triggered than we used to be, but they still snapped to their partner, froze up when they got touched a certain way, had a great month and then a panic attack year, and then just had to get the fuck out of town for a while, who were successful on their own terms but continued to still have a few deeply shitty mental health times a year, who had chosen family, queer family that was wonderful, the best, and then completely fell the fuck apart in a disastrous way that you never should have, would have expected, but actually seemed completely obvious after the fact. We're all here. Everyone's like, when are you going to write the second memoir? And I'm like, I don't know. I mean, you know, Dorothy Allison, she's like, it's been 20 years since Cave Dweller because I got to wait for some people to die. I don't know. I'm trying not to die. And I'm like, yep. You know, that's why people get into fiction. But, you know, anyway. who thought they knew everything about their abuse story but then woke up one day at 42 and thought, shit, maybe my mom also abused my older cousin who she also had a special closeness to. Or what if I'm not just grateful to be free, but deeply angry and sad that I don't have a mom? There are still not enough of those stories, and I want to have the ones where I'm 43 and life is good and life is fucked up and I still feel sad and I still feel angry and I'm still crazy and I have a lot of tools and I have the Ativan, prayer, counseling, DBT cards in my purse, weed, tinctures and crystals enough to kill somebody. And I want to say I'm not a super survivor or a super crip. I am a crypt survivor with superpowers who has joy and sadness, rage and loneliness, grief and rediscovery. And I don't want to be fixed if being fixed means being bleached of memory, untaught by what I have learned through this miracle of survivorhood. My survivorhood is not an individual problem. It is a collective problem. And I want the communion of all of us who have survived and all of our knowledge. I don't want to be fixed. I want to change the world. I want to be alive, awake, grieving, and full of joy, and deeply weird. And I am.
Thanks.
Thanks. I'm going to do a last quick thing. Is that okay? Yeah, nobody's like, get the fuck off the stage, bitch. You know, what the fuck? We want to watch This Is Us. Come on. Like, what the hell is this shit? No, we really don't want to watch This Is Us. it's really, there's a lot of shit in here. I don't know. I also want to say that one disability, there's a million disability art and aesthetic paradigms, and some of them are that, you know, like my friend Neve's like, crip years are like dog years, you know? Like, you got to get it in. And I see so much, I mean, Saraya, you've talked about this online where you were like, you know, sometimes when our disabled experience means being close to death, you know, and I don't mean this, and I know you don't mean either, but like, I think some people think, oh yeah, like when you have cancer, every day is a blessing. And it's like, but it's more like our closeness to death in reality means that we don't fuck around. And, you know, we're already marginalized. So, and that really hurts, and that's oppression, but we also have the option of being real. Right. So if I can find it, me and Stacey had an interview called Crip Lineages, Crip Futures. And I just want to say something about disabled wealth, which is a concept that I came up with. We really went in. Yeah. What does Crip wealth mean to you? I always go to Crip kindness. Crip kindness is the wealth where we notice each other's pain face and offer a chair. Ask in a low-key way, not a big deal if we can ask help with a service task. Sit without speaking, and it's totally okay. Drop a bottle of tincture next to someone having a panic attack. Raise thousands of dollars for someone to buy an accessible van or mail a stranger an extra prescription or inhaler. It's collective noticing and collective hustle. It's witnessing each other without trying to fix each other. It's being allowed to relax, expand, just be. It's also not automatic, which is a place where I want to give respect to and deepen Mia Mingus' idea of access intimacy. Like many, many other sick and disabled queers, Mia's well-known essay, Access Intimacy, has been foundational in my disability justice knowledge. And it's naming the experience of CRIP on CRIP understanding of ACLU's access needs as a place of love and communion. But sometimes some of that essay can read to me like understanding each other's access needs is an automatic and magical process, and I want to push back on that and say that while access intimacy is often a sophisticated disabled gift and we are magic and make magic, I also want to argue for access intimacy as a process and a learnable skill. I think it's dangerous when we believe that as disabled folks, we always just know each other's needs. I want us to acknowledge the ways that disabled people do have ways of knowing each other's stuff and how we also not need to not assume and ask each other. I also think it's very important to say that able people can and do commit to learning access intimacy, because otherwise we'll be stuck in this place where CRIPs are still the only ones who can do for us. I want everyone to have disabled knowledge. I want everyone to be able to show up. But CRIP wealth is also the gift of us being the normal, the regular, the gift of, yes, you can live in your sweatpants, you can change your bag in front of me, you can be really, really, really weird. The amount of time it takes you to transfer onto the toilet is completely regular. I see so many abled people running into disability or madness and illness and being so completely flummoxed by all of this because of the ableist shame that everyone swims in is so deep. And I wonder what they would be like if they even know this word of disabled wealth, if they ever even knew that there were all of us waiting here with our encyclopedia knowledge and resources, with our dueling, with our ways that we have brought ourselves and each other to the other side and the other side and the other side again of new and old disability over and over again. If they knew that we are the seed bank, the promise, the gift that we give to each other, if they said thank you, what would be the possibilities that would be so much richer for all of us? Okay, I'm gonna stop there. Thank you so much. But that's not it. Now, me and Saray, with our coordinated fans, are gonna interview. It's gonna be a talk show. You're not ready. This is gonna be a fucking talk show. Then we're gonna have this shit. And then you guys get to ask us questions. Okay, so. Yeah.
Oh, goodness. So now that I'm done, like, trying to keep my mascara from running, and now that this fan has me feeling like I'm at church, which a good church fan will do, I'm really wondering, you said a lot about survivorship, and yeah. I'm wondering what you think, other than the courage to heal, which I think many of us have some familiarity with, is the root of the idea that, like, eventually one will get over, right? Such a problematic framework of the trauma, we'll get past it. What is that? And how do you feel like it mirrors other disability paradigms, right? Like where like you'll either die or like your sickness will like get better. Like you'll be able to navigate the world better. Like how do you...
I took the pill. Wow. It's
right.
Great. Yeah.
Right. How do you think that that was formed and what do you think it means for our lives?
I don't know. You know, like... I might start saying some real weird shit, like, you know, on the first day there was this fuck. Anyway, I have a weird sense of humor. Those are really big, good questions. I don't know if I'm going to have the full answer. I do think that one part of the paradigm is that, I mean, I just think back to what I know about, like, second wave feminist, like, survivorhood culture and, like, you know, culture making, rape crisis, like, all of these things. And, you know, you have this whole wave of people breaking silence in a certain way in the 1970s and 80s, you know, in North America and also globally. And then you have this collective, oh, shit, everybody's a survivor. Wow, this is normal. And then you have like a wave that, I mean, I was, you know, I was born in 75, but I wasn't really around for that part in a, you know, conscious adult way. But I think that to me, sometimes I'm like, okay, you know, I think about what it's like at different moments in the last couple years of Me Too, where, you know, my feed where I want to go to escape and find community is just like story, 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 story. And I'm so glad they're there, but I'm just like, it's trigger ping pong.
Yes.
You know, and I just can imagine all these people in like, you know, 1974, 1975, 1981 being like, wow, we're all survivors. And this enormous ocean of grief and pain and rage and neurodivergence and, you know, complex trauma and people being like, we want, you know, we want an ending to it. Mm-hmm. And I think as human beings, a lot of the time, and I think that like to me, you know, in ways I might not be able to explain right now, I think that there's a root of ableism in this where we want some neat and pretty and quick answers. And we, I think one part, I mean, pain sucks, you know, and we all get to have our different relationships to pain. And then at the same time, as sick and disabled folks, often we're like, pain is different when you're, you know, like a lifetime achiever at it, you know, like it's, you know, I mean, it's different when an able person gets the flu and it's like the world is ending versus we're like, well, I'm on year 21 of the flu. So, you know, how is it this week? You get different skills around it. So I feel like, you know, I would wager that it's one part, can this shit be over? You know, like, can we have an end date to it? You know, can things actually get better? And I have a lot of compassion for people who, from what I know of, like, feminist survivorhood and, like, rape crisis and health movements in the 70s were just, like, I mean, some of the things that I think are really strong where they're like, we're the experts. We're going to make it up. Yes. Like, it was before professionalization. Mm-hmm. But then at the same time, people were like, I don't know, like, when does this end? What if we just feel fucked up forever? Like, this is, how the hell are we going to do this? And then I think also you see where professionalization and, like, you know, white, cis, middle class, like, professionalization of, like, let's work with the law, let's get money from the state, like, let's have people with MSWs work in the shelter, you know, things like that. You get this kind of, I mean, I actually got very daring and I think I coined the phrase survivor industrial complex in that piece where I was like, yeah, it's that, everyone, there's some people being like, oh shit, where I'm like, and I mean, I worked as a crisis line worker for a decade. You know, I'm not harshing on anyone who works in, you know, intimate and sexual violence and survivor nonprofits. Like, you know, we're all really good people trying to fucking be the one rape crisis center for a huge metropolitan area. But there are ways that the professionalization and what a lot of Black and Brown feminists have called out, where they're like, okay, so you make it a crime, cool, but then those laws get used against Black, Indigenous, POC, trans, sex working, etc., disabled people. You know, it's similar the ways in which when you just kind of make survivorhood be something that you go and you get a certificate in and it's like, here's the steps, you know, and it's over at a certain point. You know, I'm just going to trail off. Like, that is what that is.
No, that's super real.
And I think that, you know, I mean, Eli Clare actually has some really beautiful stuff in Brilliant Imperfection in his last book where he talks about being a ritual abuse survivor, you know, and he's like, yeah, I fucking did all the aromatherapy and the regular therapy and the take back the night and all this stuff. And he's like, I'm actually claiming being broken. He's like, I don't think I will wake up one day and it'll be like, just like all the torture I survived didn't happen. He's like, I don't think that's true. And I know he has some really beautiful writing where he's like, it was coming from a crip, disabled, queer and trans space, you know, where he was like, yeah, like, what does it mean to claim brokenness? What does it mean? And, you know, Blythe Barnot, who's a white working class, like, cis femme, fat preacher, you know, after, bless her soul, like, Amanda Arkansas Harris passed two years ago. In her memorial, you know, which Blythe led, Blythe talked about the Japanese practice of kintsugi, which I may be mispronouncing, but where instead of throwing away broken pottery or other practices, you put them back together with gold. And she was like, I think that's a femme survivorhood practice. I think that can be an other gendered survivorhood practice. What does it mean? And she didn't say it, but to me, that's a disabled practice. Like, And I also think that sometimes our scars aren't lined with gold. They're just scars. But what does it mean to just be with them and not try not to hate them all the time? And I don't know. I just came up with this, like, weird unified theory in the bathtub, you know, like, not that long ago. And, like, I don't know. But I'm just, like, I'm interested in, like, what are the possibilities for survivor futures that go away from let's fix it, you know? And it actually does remind me of, you know, Christos, who, God, you know, like, such a turf, you know, really, like, I'm just like, fuck, I fucking, can you just fucking not be fucked up that way? But, you know, as a young survivor, when she was writing about being an Indigenous, you know, like, femme survivor, like, she had this one piece she wrote where she was like, I don't want to, like, you know, a nice little certificate or a pill. I want a circle of survivors to just grieve and howl and mourn for days and days and days, as long as it takes. And that really stuck with me. And, you know, taking away, you know, the bullshit parts of her politics, which I can't support, which I'm very disappointed in, I'm like, I want, like, the non-transmisogynist, transphobic, like, disabled Black and Brown all-gender survivor version where we get to mourn and we get to be angry and we can also be like, what has survivorhood taught us? Like, what are our survivorhood skills? Which we don't often get asked. You know, often we get, you know, just told, like, oh, you know, we're never told there's anything that is good or strong or learnable from our survivorhood. And that feels really connected to me in the ways in which the medical industrial complex and like fucked up world just said that disability is just like a tragedy and there's nothing strong or beautiful or amazing or, you know, really needed that comes from all the ways we're disabled.
Absolutely.
Okay, that was a lot, but I hope that made sense.
It did.
Yeah.
Like, cool. I think that this has been such a particular set of years, right? Because, like, as a disabled person in me, like, in the Me Too era, generation, whatever way we want to talk about this passage of time, like, there just could not be one, right? Like, as a growing up as an autistic child, I could mark my days by how many times I was molested, you know, like there's just not going to be a time where I can talk about a singular instance of abuse that happened. It is not finite. It is infinite. And because of that, I think that there is a way that we had to compartmentalize to people whose stories were in fact finite, right? Like where it's like, here's the thing that happened. It had a start, a middle, and an end. It's over now. It happened some other time. And thus we can reckon with the idea of its temporality, right? Like disabled time, crip time is, it is not non-disabled time, right? Like you expect people not to show up. People who like said, until the very moment, like I'm on my way, right? But they were not on their way, right? They were on their way in their hearts. And that is one of the ways to travel to us, but it is only one of the ways, right? And it is understanding that your friend might call in and you will have a good conversation, right? To your party or your event. It is definitely about making space for someone who got suddenly sick at your party and is now staying over, right? And I think that that temporality doesn't just stop at the event, at the party, at the gathering, right? It goes throughout our entire lives and changes, I think, many disabled people's idea of normalcy. I'm interested to, as to multiply disabled people, right? Ambulatory, certainly. Just thinking about like the ways in which, do you ever feel like you're forced to like choose or prioritize one of your disabilities over your other disabilities or like some parts of your disability experience over other parts of your disability experience? And how do you deal with that?
Yeah, good question. Short answer, yes, probably. I mean, and then the longer answer, like, yeah, all the time. But it's also like, it's kind of like that crip time thing too, where I'm like, you know, one of our skills is we bend time. We're time travelers. Slow time is so huge. You know, speed time is so fast. And then I'm in those moments where like, you know, I'm always, we're both always all of who we are. You know, I feel like I kind of veer between people being like, you're the exception. You're not really disabled. I'm going to ignore everything you say. You're there on a stage, so you can't be disabled, you know, and people and just people being like, you know, and I think it's interesting because I had a real, I think talking about like, I'm really interested. I was talking with Alice Shepard about this at the Disability Intersectionality Summit about like disabled aesthetics and disabled black and brown aesthetics and what it means to turn away from like trying to be included and really just be like, what are all the ways we do this stuff? And we were both talking about, I was like, yeah, you know, in my 30s, like my 20s, I was just like, you know, like sleeping 18 hours a day, cleaning floors, like whatever, you know, landscaping, struggling, you know, really being in a lot of trauma. And then my 30s, I kind of, you know, moved to California and quit smoking. And like, you know, I kind of had an upswing and I had more crip community and I had one, you know, really close disabled poor friend who had a similar chronic illness to me. And he was like, yeah, so you can't really do a 9-to-5 because you'll get pneumonia and you'll go nuts. But what you do is, you know, you've got good days and bad days. So just do gigs and you can really go hard on the good days and you crash afterwards. Now, like, and I really went for that. Like, I look at my Google calendars and I'm like, Jesus fucking Christ. And you know, I mean, so many people were like, but that's how I got social capital after a disabled 20s and a crazy 20s and an autistic 20s, though I didn't know I was autistic, where I had very little social capital in a lot of ways. And I went really fucking hard. And also I was like, I don't know how long I've got this. So sure. So now I'm in my 40s and like, I'm more of a shut in. I, you know, really thought about not getting on the plane for this tour. Cause I was like, I got my bed and my cats, you know, that's all I need. I really don't want to leave my bed and my cats. So long story short, like, I feel like, you know, it depends, but I feel like, you know, some ables will be like, okay, the cane. So you've got that thing. You've got some kind of pain thing. You've got some kind of illness thing. You take these pills. But then, you know, the autism thing, like, you know, and like, there's so many ways to be autistic. There's so many ways to be read as autistic. But, you know, people are just like, you know, like they're just still in the like, you can't possibly be da 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 da. And I think that for a lot of people who have you know, are in the similar autism ocean of like, I can talk a lot sometimes, you know, like we get put in that place where it's like all the times that I am mute, I have mutism and I can't talk and I really need to be alone, just get erased. Right. And I do think that people are like, we can deal with one thing, you know, like barely, we can't even really deal with the one thing, but like, you know, the multiverse, like, no, we're not going to do that.
And it's a post-institutional model.
It's a post-institutional model of like, you know, just like the one piece of the Trivial Pursuit thing, you know, the little corner, and that's it. But mostly I feel like either people are well-meaning or they erase most or all of it, to be honest, when it's not within our communities.
Yeah, I think that people are really comfortable with an idea of an autistic savant, and then like when they meet autistic people who are like smart, or like who they think of as like smart, or like who they feel like model intelligence in the way that autistic people do, like then that is cause for you not to be autistic. Meanwhile, I feel like not only was I diagnosed as a child, which people use as a benchmark, like I had to do ABA, like people like legitimately like were like, you gonna be as autistic as you can be or else. And if those things are effective and then you can like ape an idea of able-bodied normalcy, then like you are then not accommodated, right? And so that's why I say that it's a post-institutional model, right? The idea that all disabled people should be in institutions, and if you are not in an institution, you have escaped that model, and thus you are not
disabled. Just like, you're just like me, so you don't need anything, so it's fine. And like I had this experience where I ran into somebody the other day when I was in Western Mass who had done some really like fuckery like 8 years ago, like ableist fuckery. And like, I didn't know they'd moved to Northampton, but there they were. And I have my like, you know, double huge baggies of all of my pills, you know? And then they're all like, oh, you're so good. I always forget to take my supplements. And I just looked at them and I was just like real beady eyed. And I was like, I have a lifelong disability. This is what I take to walk. It's 8 of them every day. And they were just like, oh yeah, yeah. Blah, 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 blah. And I was just like, okay, you know, it's just like the willful refusal. Also, and I was just like, and it's, you know, there's like, you know, I get stuck on things. So like, there's like the piece of disability justice performance art that really brought me in was the opening to Sins and Valor 2009, where, you know, it's Maori wheelchair dancer Rodney Bell being, some of you may have seen it, like being like suspended like 40 feet above the stage as a cross is projected on him, as Patty is saying like, you know, is this safe? Are you safe? Are you so afraid of us, the deviant, the disabled, the dissident? You know, are you so afraid you might be stained by our leaking needs? Is that why you lock us up? Is that why you try and kill us even before birth? And I was just like, and I mean, this is in the book too, but like, shout out to Patty, where I was like, how come you don't do a workshop? And she's like, yeah, I could do that, or I could just make performance art that fucks people up in 3 minutes, and that's a disabled way of doing art. And it worked for me. But I was also like, yeah, you know, some people will stay afraid even after they become disabled. They will stay afraid and unwilling. They will be disabled and not use the word disability, or they will stay abled and they will just not be able to witness you forever. You know, I could put a neon fucking sign on my forehead. It wouldn't make a difference.
It's true. Carolyn Lazard and I have been talking a lot about that recently, especially in the Black community, right? Like where like there is a reluctance to call oneself disabled, even in the face of it, like of just obvious disability. And I think that a lot of that too is like coming like after enslavement and like the penalty for being disabled and no longer being valuable as a product, as no longer being having a use value that is legible for the people who benefit from your capital or from your labor, rather. And I think that that is really cultural, right? Like I was, even to this day, I'm like encouraged even by the disabled people in my life to like identify as non-disabled. Yeah. And I'm like, how are we going to work that out? You know, like how am I going to be like, yeah, I have lupus, but that's a kind of health, you know, like it's just not, it's not reality, you know, like there's like a, I feel like if I didn't lean into sickness when I did, I would have died. Right. And looking at my mother,
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? I'm brought to you live.
Welcome back to The Avalanche. You are just listening to an episode of AAWW Radio. To listen to the remainder of this episode, go to aawradio.libsyn.com. This episode was titled Disability Justice. And that completes this episode of The Avalanche, a special edition of Off the Hour, airing every Wednesday from 5 to 6. To stay up to date with Avalanche news, check out our Twitter, @AvalancheCKUT. Thank yous are due to all those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CKUT possible. If you would like more information on anything you heard tonight, or would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact The Avalanche at avalancheckut.ca or CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or email news at CKUT.ca. Stay tuned for Hersey. That's up next. Hey, you. Come over here and listen.
Oh, God, I'm so fucking wet. Yeah. Yeah. Like that. Like that. Oh, God.
You can't hear me.
I would love your cock to be inside me. Oh, God, I'm really gonna come. I'm really gonna come. Oh, God, I'm so fucking wet. Can you see how wet I am? Can you see how wet I am? Oh, fuck. Yeah. 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 Oh, fuck.
It's time for Audio Smut. It's time for Audio Smut. Smut, smut, smut,
smut, smut, smut.
A queer, feminist, trans positive radio show about fucking in all its forms.
Two, three, four, five fingers.
Let's not beat around the bush. This show contains explicit sexual content.